This is Audible.
You are about to hear Rational Fasting by Arnold Errett, narrated by John Riddle. Copyright 2018, BN Publishing, online at bnpublishing.com. Preface. Are you one of the thousands of present-age persons, discouraged and disheartened because of ill health? Is your faith in so-called cures shattered after having tried them without results? Are you only able to use a small percent of the vitality that good Mother Nature endows her beloved ones with? Probably you have been told that only an operation will save you. Somehow, when we suffer organic trouble, we fail to think clearly and permit ourselves to be easily persuaded into operations. If you are one of these unfortunates, don't give up hope. For he that hath health hath hope, and he that hath hope hath everything. Since man degenerated through civilization, he no longer knows what to do when he becomes sick. The genuine principles of healing are simple and few. Our very lack of appetite, which occurs when we are sick, is nature's method of teaching her children. One might properly call this a forced fast. These are but a few of the truisms taught by Arnold Errett in his many writings, Our Greatest Possession is Health. A general agreement seems to be gaining acceptance among an increasing number of practitioners, both of the drugless as well as the medical fraternity, that the fundamental cause of disease is the presence of foreign material in the human body. But it has not as yet led to the discovery of the roots of this invading mystery. Professor Errett has conclusively proven that this disease-causing material is the undigested, uneliminated, and decayed, rotting food elements resulting from too much eating of wrong foods. It is, therefore, entirely reasonable and should be clearly seen that the main factor in the health enigma should consist of dietetics. If overeating is the main cause of the patient's disease, it requires intelligently conducted fasts to correct the condition. It is a known fact that all of the animal kingdom living in a natural environment instinctively heal themselves through fasting. It can be easily proven that persons living on a mixed diet of animal flesh and starchy vegetables has a system more or less clogged with mucus. This condition has been going on since early childhood, in fact, even before. These foods are not suitable for mankind, and they form a sticky, gluey consistency which eventually clogs the circulation. Is it not self-evident and certainly reasonable that this disease-producing eating must be stopped? Fasting, plus a degree in the quantity of food eaten daily, is the only check on overeating. Exercise due precaution not to proceed too rapidly, for an unwise application of the eliminative process could cause a serious condition to develop. This drugless healing is not limited in its scope, and through its proper application and use, it restores normal functioning, overcoming practically all ailments to which the human family is subject. Truth wears no mask, bows at no human shrine, seeks neither place nor applause. She asks only a hearing. Redfield. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Common Fundamental Cause in the Nature of Diseases by Professor Arnold Errett. All the phases of the process of development of the medical science, including those of the earliest periods of civilization, have in their way of understanding the causal nature of diseases, that one thing in common, i.e., that the diseases, owing to external causes, enter into the human body and thus, by force of a necessary or at least unavoidable law, disturb the body in its existence, cause it pain, and at last destroy it. Even modern medical science, no matter how scientifically enlightened it pretends to be, has not quite turned away from this basic note of demoniac interpretation. In fact, The most modern achievement, bacteriology, rejoices over every newly discovered bacillus as a further addition to the army of beings whose accepted task it is to endanger the life of man. Looking at it from a philosophical standpoint, this interpretation differs from the medieval superstition and the period of fetishism only in the supplemental name. Formerly, it was an evil spirit, which imagination went so far as to believe in satanic personages. Now, this same dangerous monster is a microscopically visible being whose existence has been proven beyond any doubt. The matter, it is true, has still a great drawback in the so-called disposition, a fine word, but what we really are to understand by it, nobody has ever told us. All the tests on animals with their symptom reactions do not prove anything sure, because these occur only by means of injection into the blood circulation and never by introduction into the digestive channel through the mouth. There is something true in the conception of external invasion of a disease as well as in heredity, however not in the sense that the invader is a spirit, demon, hostile to life, or a microscopic being, bacillus. But all diseases, without exception, even the hereditary, are caused, disregarding a few other hygienic causes, by biologically wrong, unnatural food, and by each ounce of overnourishment only and exclusively. First of all, I maintain that in all diseases, without exception, there exists a tendency by the organism to secrete mucus, and in case of a more advanced age, pus, decomposed blood. Of course, every healthy organism must also contain a certain mucus lymph, a fatty substance of the bowels, etc., of a mucus nature. Every expert will admit this in all catarrhalic cases, from a harmless cold in the nose to inflammation of the lungs and consumption, as well as in epilepsy, attack showing froth at the mouth, mucus. Where this secretion of mucus does not show freely and openly, as in cases of ear, eye, skin, or stomach trouble, heart diseases, rheumatism, gout, etc., even in all degrees of insanity, mucus is the main factor of the illness. The natural secretive organs unable to cope with it longer, the mucus enters the blood causing heat, inflammation, pain and fever at the respective spot where the vessel system is probably contracted owing to an overcooling fever, cold, heat, inflammation, pain, fever, etc. We need only to give a patient of any kind nothing but mucusless food. For instance, fruit or even nothing but water or lemonade. We then find that the entire digestive energy, freed for the first time, throws itself upon the mucus matters, accumulated since childhood and frequently hardened, as well as on the pathologic beds formed therefrom. And the result? With unconditional certainty, this mucus, which I mark as the common, basic, and main cause for all diseases, will appear in the urine and in the excrement. If the disease is already somewhat advanced so that in some spot, even in the innermost interior, there have appeared pathologic beds, i.e. decomposed cellular tissues, then pus is also secreted. As soon as the introduction of mucus by means of artificial food, fat meat, bread, potatoes, farinaceous products, rice, milk, etc., ceases, the blood circulation attacks the mucus and the pus of the body themselves and secretes them through the urine, and in the case of heavily infected bodies, even through all the openings at their command, as well as through the mucus membranes. If potatoes, grain meal, rice, or the respective meat materials are boiled long enough, we receive jelly-like slime, mucus, or paste used by bookbinders and carpenters. This mucus substance soon becomes sour, ferments, and forms a bed for fungi, molds, and bacilli. In the process of digestion, which is nothing else but a boiling, a combustion, this slime or paste is being secreted in the same manner, for the blood can use only the ex-digested sugar transformed from starch. The secreted matter, the superfluous product, i.e. this paste or slime, is being completely excreted in the beginning. It is, therefore, easy to understand that in the course of life, the intestines and the stomach are gradually being pasted and slimed up to such an extent that this paste of floral and this slime of faunal origin turn into fermentation, clog up the blood vessels, and finally decompose the stagnated blood. If figs, dates, or grapes are boiled down thick enough, we also receive a pap which, however, does not turn to fermentation and never secretes slime, but which is called syrup. Fruit sugar, the most important thing for the blood, is also sticky, it is true, but is being completely used up by the body as the highest form of fuel, and leaves for excretion only traces of cellulose, which, not being sticky, is promptly excreted and does not ferment. Boiled down sugar, owing to its resistance against fermentation, is even used for the preservation of food. Each healthy or sick person deposits on the tongue a sticky mucus as soon as he reduces his food or fasts. This occurs also on the mucous membrane of the stomach, of which the tongue is an exact copy. In the first stool after fasting, this mucus makes its appearance. I recommend to my reader or to the physicians and searchers to test my claims by way of experiments which alone are entitled to real scientific recognition. The experiment, the question put to nature, is the basis of a natural science and reveals the infallible truth no matter whether it is stated by me or someone else. Furthermore, I recommend the following experiments to those who are brave enough to test on their own bodies, which I undertook on mine. They will receive the same answer from nature, i.e. from their organism, provided that the latter be sound, in my sense, exact, to a certain degree reacts only to the clean, sound, mucusless organism. After a 2-year strict fruit diet with intercalated fasting cures, I had attained a degree of health which is simply not imaginable nowadays, and which allowed of my making the following experiments. With a knife, I made an incision in my lower arm. There was no flow of blood as it thickened instantly, closing up the wound. No inflammation, no pain, no mucus and pus. Healed up in 3 days, blood crust thrown off. Later, with vegetaric food, including mucus ferments, starch food, but without eggs and milk, the wound bled a little, caused some pain, and pussed slightly, a light inflammation, complete healing only after some time. After that, the same wounding with meat food and some alcohol. Longer bleeding, the blood of a light color, red and thin, inflammation, pain, pussing for several days, and healing only after a 2 days fasting. I have offered myself, of course, in vain to the Prussian Ministry of War for a repetition of this experiment. Why is it that the wounds of the Japanese healed much quicker and better in the Russo-Japanese War than those of the meat and brandy Russians? Has nobody for 2,000 years ever thought it over why the opening of the artery and even the poison cup could not kill Seneca after he had despised meat and fasted in prison? It is said that even before that, Seneca fed on nothing but fruit and water. All disease is finally nothing else but a clogging up of the smallest blood vessels, the capillaries, by mucus. Nobody will want to clean the water conduit of a city, a pipe system which is fed with soiled water by a pump, the filters of which are clogged up, without having the water supply shut off during the cleaning process. If the conduit supplies the entire city or a portion of it with unclean water, or if even the smallest branch pipes are clogged up, there is no man in the world who would repair or improve that respective spot. Everybody thinks at once of the central, of the tank and the filters, and these together with the pumping machine can be cleaned only as long as the water supply is shut off. I am the Lord, thy physician, English and modern. Nature alone heals, cleans, on mucuses best, and infallibly sure, but only if the supply, or at least the mucus supply, is stopped. Each physiological machine, man like beast, cleanses itself immediately, dissolves the mucus in the clogged up vessels without stopping short as soon as the supply of compact food at least is interrupted. Even in the case of the supposedly healthy man, This mucus, as already mentioned, then appears in the urine where it can be seen after cooling off in the proper glass tubes. Whoever denies, ignores, or fights this uniform fact, because perhaps it is not in accord with his teachings, or is not sufficiently scientific, is jointly guilty of the impossibility of detection of the principal cause of all diseases, and this in the first place to his own detriment. Therewith I also uncover the last secret of consumption. Or does anybody believe that this enormous quantity of mucus thrown off by a patient stricken with tuberculosis for years and years emanates only from the lung itself? Just because this patient is then almost forcibly fed on mucus, pap, milk, fat meats, the mucus can never cease until the lung itself decays, and the bacilli make their appearance when death becomes inevitable. The mystery of the bacilli is solved simply thus. The gradual clogging up of the blood vessels by mucus leads to decomposition, to fermentation of these mucus products, and boiled dead food residues. These decay partially on the living body. Pussy abscesses, cancer, tuberculosis, syphilis, lupus, etc. Now, everybody knows that meat, cheese, and all organic matter will again germinate, put forth bacilli, during the process of decomposition. It is for this reason that these germs appear and are detectable only in the more advanced stage of the disease, when, however, they are not the cause but the product of the disease, and disease furthering only insofar as the decomposition, for instance, of the lung, is being hastened by them, because the excretions of the bacilli, their toxins, act poisoning. If it be correct that bacilli invade, infect from the exterior, then it is nothing but the mucus which makes possible their activity and furnishes the proper soil, the disposition. As already stated, I have repeatedly, once for 2 years, lived mucusless, i.e. on fruit, exclusively. I was no longer in need of a handkerchief, which product of civilization I hardly need even up to this date. Has anyone ever seen a healthy animal living in freedom, expectorate, or blow its nose? A chronic inflammation of the kidneys, considered deadly, which I was stricken with, was not only healed, but I am enjoying a degree of health and efficiency which far surpasses even that of my healthiest youth. I want to see the man who, being sick unto death at 31, who can run for 2 hours and a quarter without a stop, or make an endurance march of 56 hours duration, 8 years later. It is surely theoretically correct that man was a mere fruit-eater in times gone by, and biologically correct that he can be it even today, or that the horse sense of man not conceived without any direct proofs of the fact that man, becoming a hunter, lived on fruits only. I even maintain that he did live in absolute health, beauty, and strength without pain and grief, just the way the Bible says. Fruit only, the sole mucusless food, is natural. Everything prepared by man or supposedly improved by him is evil. The arguments regarding fruit are scientifically exact. In the apple or banana, for instance, everything can be found contained what man needs. Man is so perfect that he can live on one kind of fruit only, at least for quite some time. This has been conclusively proven by the mono diet system of August Engelhardt, who solved by his great philosophy and practice of natural life all problems of mankind. But a self-evident truth preached by nature must not be discarded just because no one has been able to apply it in actual practice on account of civilizational considerations. From the eating of fruit only, one gets a first crisis, i.e. cleansing. No man would have ever believed me that it is possible to live without food for 126 days, in which 49 were undertaken at a stretch during a period covering 14 months. Now I have done it, and yet this truth is not being understood. Hitherto I state and will teach only this fact that fruit is the most natural healing remedy. Whether my calculation is correct will be proven by the next epidemic. I take, however, this opportunity to uncover the reasons why the self-evident is not believed in. When in the previous century someone talked about the possibility of phoning from London to Paris, everybody laughed because there had never been such a thing. Natural food is not being believed in anymore because almost no one practices it, and living in today's civilization, we cannot easily practice it. It must also be considered that contra-interests fear that the prices of other artificial foodstuffs may drop, and others fear that the food physiology may receive a shock and physicians become unnecessary. But it is just this fasting and fruit cure which requires very strict observation and instruction, therefore, more doctors and less patients who, however, will gladly pay more if they get well. Thus the social question regarding doctors is solved, an assertion already made by me publicly in Zurich several years ago. Almost all fasting attempts fail through ignorance of the fact that with the beginning of the mucusless diet, the old mucus is being excreted so much more forcibly until that person is absolutely clean and healthy. Thus, the seemingly most healthy person has first to pass through a condition of sickness, cleansing, or go through an intermediate stage of illness to a higher level of health. This is the great cliff around which so few vegetarians have failed to go, discarding the basic truth just like the mass of people are doing. I have proven this fact in the Vegetarische Warte completely on the basis of experiments and facts, and refuting their greatest objection, that of undernourishment by an actual fasting experiment of 49 days with a preceding fruit diet. My state of health was greatly improved through this radical excretion of mucus, disregarding a few unhygienic circumstances during the test. I received numerous letters of appreciation, especially from the educated classes. The mass adherents of vegetarianism, mucuses gaily ahead. Contrasting herewith, it can only be said that the poisons, so-called by them, meat, alcohol, coffee, and tobacco, are in the long run comparatively harmless, as long as they are used moderately. In order to avoid misunderstanding on the part of teetotalers and vegetarians, I must insert here a few explanations. Meat is not a foodstuff, but only a stimulant with ferments, decays in the stomach, the process of decay, however, does not begin in the stomach, but at once after the slaughtering. This is already proven on living persons by Professor Dr. S. Graham, and I complete this fact by saying that meat acts as a stimulant just by means of these poisons of decay, and therefore is being erroneously regarded as a strengthening foodstuff. Or is there anyone who can show me chemico-physiologically that the albumin molecule going through the process of decay is being newly reformed in the stomach and celebrates its resurrection in some muscle of the human body? Like alcohol, the meat produces in the beginning stimulating strength and energy until the entire organism is penetrated by it and the breakdown inevitable. All the other stimulants act likewise. This, therefore, is a false delusion. The fundamental evil of all non-vegetarian forms of diet consists always in the overeating of meat, as it is the origin of all the other evils, especially in the craving for alcohol. If fruit is eaten almost exclusively, the eagerness for cup or glass loses itself to chastise himself against it, simply because meat produces the demon thirst. Alcohol is a proven kind of antidote for meat, and the gourmand of the big city, who eats practically nothing but meat, must therefore have wines, mocha, and Havana in order to at least in some way counteract the heavy meat poisoning. It is a well-known fact that after an opulent dinner, one feels decidedly fresher, physically and mentally, if the stimulants, poisonous in themselves, are taken moderately rather than to stuff oneself full with the good eating to the very fatigue. I absolutely declare war on meat and alcohol. Through fruit and moderate eating, these great evils are radically diminished. But whoever finds it impossible to entirely give up meat and alcohol is, if he takes them moderately, still far ahead of the vegetarian over or excess eater. The American Fletcher proved this most evidently by his tremendous success, and his secret is explained by my experiments, which show that a person becomes most efficient and develops best in health if he eats as little as possible. Are not the oldest people, as a rule, the poorest? Have not the greatest discoverers and inventors sprung from poverty, i.e. been little eaters? Were not the greatest of mankind, the prophets, founders of religions, etc., esoterics? Is that culture, to dine excellently thrice a day, and is it social progress that each working man eats five times a day and then pumps himself full with beer at night? If the sick organism can regenerate by eating nothing, I think the logical consequence is that a healthy organism needs but little food in order to remain healthy, strong, and persevering. All so-called miracles of the saints have their only origin in ascetics and are today impossible but for the simple reason that, although much praying is done, no fasting is adhered to. This is the only solution of this quarrel. We have no more miracles because we have no more saints, i.e. sanctified and healed by ascetics and fastings. The saints were self-shining, expressed in modern language, medial or radioactive, but only through asceticism. They were godly, healthy, and not by special grace. I just wish to mention here that I myself have succeeded in visible electric effluences, but only by external and internal sun energies, sun baths and food from the sun kitchen, fruit. The entire world is quarreling now regarding these questions and miracles. And here is the solution on the basis of experiments which everybody can repeat if he is brave enough. But it is apparently easier to write books, preach and pray, or to say that I am an exception. This is true, but only so far as pluck and understanding are concerned. Physiologically, all men are equal, and whoever cannot be moderate may learn it from me if he wishes to be a real searcher after health. If a man eats little and is healthy, he can, for quite a length of time, digest the most absurd food, meat and starch, mucus, i.e., he can again excrete it. Naturally, he becomes and remains still more perfect and clean if he eats but little fruit, and of this he needs the least because it is the most perfect food. This eternal truth, by natural law, man of today will and cannot admit, and has a well-founded fear of it, because he is built up of dead boiled food, and his cells die off and are excreted as soon as he takes his sun baths, fast, or eats the living cells of fruits. But this cure must be done with the greatest care. The duty of medicine is to protect man from a breakdown of his cells, to hold him above water as long as is possible, only to cause him to die of the disease so much more promptly and quickly, which today is fervently wished for. Vegetarianism cannot deny that the consumers of meat and alcohol can also boast of much health and great deeds and high age, but taken individually and as a people only so long as but little is eaten and no overnourishment caused. Eating too much takes less revenge in case of meat eating because meat contains proportionately less mucus than starch-containing mucus, vegetarian food, and the celebrated vegetarian dinners, with entirely too many dishes daily. I myself have not cared for many years for any meals. I eat only when I have appetite, and then so little that it does not cause any harmful effect. If on account of an experiment I am obliged to eat something which in itself is not entirely free from objection. If the most serious diseases can be cured by fasting, which has been proven in thousands of cases, and if during the fast one becomes stronger if it is done right, then the most energetic food, the fruit, should cause one so much the more to become strong and healthy. This has been scientifically proven by the merited Dr. Bircher. It is true the science of cure by nature has recognized the fact that something must get out of the sick organism. but it has so far ascribed the greatest importance to physical stimulations, ignoring completely the real, natural moment to the process of cure, the abstaining from food and through following a fruit diet. At least, they have only offered a substitute by a non-alcohol and meatless diet. This does not mean much in the face of my mucus theory. And what is this mucusless alcohol not accused of today? It will soon be made the scapegoat of all diseases because here and there is found a depraved one who, consuming it in enormous quantities, ends in delirium. Just compel a drinker to fast a few days or to eat nothing but fruit. I will wager that the best glass of beer will have lost its flavor for him. This proves that the entire civilized mess, from beefsteak down to apparently harmless oatmeals, creates the desire for these detested antidotes: alcohol, coffee, tea, tobacco. Why? Because much eating paralyzes, and only the use of stimulants restores. Here is the true and fundamental reason for the increase of alcohol consumption: the overnourishment, especially with meat. Professor Dr. Graham says in his Physiology of Nourishment, a drinker can reach a high age. A glutton, never. This is true because the acute alcohol acts as a stimulant, and especially the modern beer is less harmful in the long run than the chronic stuffing up of the digestive channel with mucus-forming food. I now ask, what appeals more to reason to wipe out the masses of mucus piled up since childhood, or having infected the cellular tissues of the body by poisonous drugs, or parts cut away by useless avoidable operations, having the cure delayed by one-sided osteopathy? Chiropractic malpractice, misunderstood electrical treatments, mucus-forming and often unclean milk cures, weakening hot springs treatments, the Christian Science superstition, etc., or simply to stop the further supply of mucus caused by unnatural diet? Or is there anybody who would like to prove to me that the most skillful chef or confectioner is capable of producing something better than an apple, a grape, or a banana? If nourishment by mucus and overeating is the true fundamental cause of all diseases without exception, which I can prove to anybody on his own body, then there can exist but one natural remedy, i.e., fasting and fruit diet. That every animal fast in case of even the slightest uneasiness is a well-known fact, and to culture and thanks to man feeding them, domestic animals have lost their sharp instinct for the right kind of food and the natural hours of feeding, and therewith their proper state of health and acuteness of sense, they never will, nevertheless, when sick, accept only the most necessary food. They fast themselves back to health. Poor sick man, however, must under no circumstances live on short rations for more than 1 or 2 days, for fear that he may lose strength. Already, many leading physicians have called fasting wonder cures, cure of the uncured, cure of all cures, etc. Certain charlatans have brought this infallible, but at the same time dangerous cure to discredit it. I have done in fasting the most significant thing in centuries, 49 days, world record. See Vigatadasha Bharata, 1909, Book 19, 20, 22, 1920, Book 1 and 2. Furthermore, I am the only one who combines this cure with systematically and individually adapted fruit diet, which makes it astonishingly easier and absolutely harmless. We are, therefore, undoubtedly put in a position to heal diseases which the school of medicine designates as incurable. On the basis of my deduction, that this mucus coming from cultured food is the fundamental cause and main factor in the nature of all diseases, symptoms of age, obesity, falling out of the hair, wrinkles, weakness of nerves and memory, etc., there is justified hope for the creation of a new phase of development of the progressive healing methods and biological medicine. Already, Hippocrates had uniformly recognized the disease material for all diseases. Professor Jaeger has defined the common as stench, but had not discovered the source of this bad smell. Dr. Laman and other representatives of the physical dietetic tendency, especially Kuhn, came on the tracks of the common foreign matter. But not one of them showed, recognized, or proved by experiment that it is this very mucus of culture food which loads up our organism from childhood and attacks it at a certain degree of fermentation, forms pathologic beds, i.e., decomposes the cellular tissue of the body itself into pus and decay. It is being mobilized in case of casual colds or high temperatures, etc., and produces in its tendency to leave the body symptoms of abnormal functions which hitherto have been regarded as the disease itself. It is, therefore, for the first time, possible to define what is meant by decomposition. The more the mucus, bad mother's milk and all its substitutes, is being administered from childhood on, or the less this mucus is being excreted, owing to hereditary weakness, through the organs made to perform this task, the greater is the inclination to catch cold, fever, to freeze, to admit parasites, to get sick, and to prematurely grow old. Very likely by this the veil has been lifted from the secret which hitherto has always surrounded the nature of the white corpuscles. I believe that here, as in many other cases, we are confronted with an error of medical science. The bacteria throw themselves upon the white corpuscles, composed to the largest extent of this mucus, denounced by me. Are not the bacteria being bred on this mucus by the millions outside of the organism? On potatoes, broth, gelatin, i.e. on mucus, i.e. nitrogenous. Vegetable or animal substances consisting of an alkalically reacting fluid containing granulated cells of the appearance of the white blood corpuscles. Perhaps in an entirely healthy condition, the so-called mucous membrane should not at all be white, slimy, but clean and red, like on animals. Perhaps this corpse mucus is even the cause of the paleness of the white race. Pale face, corpse color. With this mucus theory to be confirmed by experiment, the specter disease has been finally deprived of its demoniac mask. He who believes me can heal not only himself, if everything else fails, but we have for the first time been given the means to radically prevent disease and to make it definitely impossible. Even the dream of lasting youth and beauty is now about to come true. The animal, and especially the human organism, is, from a mechanical standpoint, a complicated tube system of blood vessels with air gas impetus by means of the lungs in which the blood fluid is constantly kept moving and regulated by the heart as a valve. The decomposition of the air gas is accomplished by each breath in the lungs, separating of the air into oxygen and nitrogen. Thus the blood is constantly kept moving, and the human body does its service incredibly long without fatigue. Let nobody come to me with the silly excuse of the daily experience of the absolutely natural compulsion of much eating, prescribed for the working man, etc., before it has not been experienced by such complainant. How long is it possible to work or march without fatigue after fasting or fruit food? Fatigue is in the first place a reducing of strength by too much digestion work. Secondly, a dogging up of the heated and consequently narrowed down blood vessels. And thirdly, a self and repoisoning through the excretion of mucus during the motion. All organic substances of animal origin excrete cyanate groups in their decomposition, which the chemist Hensel has defined as bacilli proper. The air is not only the highest and most perfect operating material of the human body, but simultaneously the first element for the erection, repair, substitute, and very likely the animal organism derives nitrogen also from the air. On certain caterpillars, an increase of weight through air alone has been stated. Complete fasting, followed by a decrease in the quantity of food eaten, is the only check on overeating, and a diet of non-mucus-forming foods must replace the mucus-forming foods. Fresh tree-ripened fruits and the green-leaf starchless vegetables have long been recognized, and my mucusless diet healing system is already a well-proven fact. Neither fasting nor the fruit diet have been accepted by the medical authorities, nor have they been used by others in strict accordance with the condition of the patient. Yet when properly combined as a systematic cleansing, the treatment has been remarkably successful and satisfactory. The degree of the individual's weakness, together with the disturbing sensations experienced by the patient, are an extremely important factor that must be given full consideration. My cure is the only one on record that can be regulated and controlled as to speed. Chapter 2. Remedies for the removal of the common fundamental cause of diseases and the prevention of their reoccurrence. After having told my readers the dread and horror of being sick or getting sick in the previous chapter, it befits me to show them the means and ways, as far as this, commonly speaking, is possible, how to successfully encounter mucus poisoning, this greatest foe of health. Here I wish to show the means and ways which can produce a beneficial change. 1. The shortest and best way is the fasting so much talked about in this book. It cuts short the life of the grim misdoer in our body and causes him to flee, and he leaves us faster with fright and terror. Healthy people can submit themselves to a fasting cure without any further ceremony. It goes without saying that they must fast reasonably and assume personal responsibility and not cause dangerous exertions during the fasting period, by demanding of themselves physical or mental performances which they could not live up to even at full fare. I insert here a precautionary measure which must be observed in all fasting cures, the complete emptying of the bowels at the beginning of the fasting by harmless purgative, such as an aromatic herb compound, or by a syringe, or by both. It lies in the nature of the thing that he who fasts must not be bothered by gas or decomposing matter which form from the excrements remaining in the bowels. It suffices that the mucus during the excretion gives him enough trouble, as already stated. If it is not desired to take a more prolonged fast, although he is healthy, one should try a short one. Even a fasting of 36 hours, weekly, one or two times, can be depended upon to produce very favorable results. It is best to start by leaving off the supper and taking an enema instead. Then, in the case of a 36 hours fast, nothing is eaten until the following morning, the meal to consist of nothing but fruits. The eating of fruit is desirable after each fasting, as the juices of the fruits cause a moving of the mucus masses, which have loosened. However, let me caution all, especially the sick and elderly people, this treatment must be carefully individualized. One arrives at this result much sooner, however, if a longer fasting is done in the way described, for instance, 3 days, and then continue what I call an after-fasting cure. That is, do not eat anything for 3 days and drink only fresh lemonade, unsugared, in single gulps as may become necessary, and begin on the 4th day with some fruits. At the close of the 4th day, take a thorough enema. More fruits may be added from day to day until about the 7th day of the after cure. The normal quantity of fruit diet in the proper composition and selection has been reached. The fasting, however, can be extended for weeks by healthy persons and by those whose occupation permits of their spending their time in bed in case of difficult excretions of mucus. Nobody should seriously object to the so-called bad looks or the decrease in weight. The body fasts itself into health despite the miserable complexion, and in a remarkably short time the cheeks will be adorned by a healthy, natural red. The weight is also restored to its normal standard very soon after the fasting. After a fast, the body reacts on every ounce of food. Very moderate eaters and frequently fasting people have a very fine, spiritual expression of the face. It is said that Pope Leo XIII, that great faster and life artist, had a very clear, almost transparent complexion. In this connection, I wish to call attention to another point already mentioned elsewhere, for the success of the fasting depends upon it to a great extent. The fasting person must not unnecessarily become depressed or ill-humored. The one condition finds relief in the disagreeable moments by complete rest, the other by quick and decided work, especially in light and mechanical occupation. When the body has been ridden of the mucus, slime, and paste, then it is the sacred duty of the person who has regained health to keep up the reclaimed highest earthly happiness and to guard it by means of natural correct food. On this subject, a few short remarks in the following paragraphs will not come amiss. 2. He who cannot fast because of considerations of advanced lung or heart trouble, for instance, may at least see to it that the further accumulation of mucus be cut short by refraining from pronounced mucus formers, especially from all flour, cake, rice, potato dishes, boiled milk, cheese, meat, etc. Whoever cannot miss bread entirely must eat black or white bread, only toasted. By toasting, the bread loses much of its harmfulness, as the mucus substances are partly destroyed. The eating of toasted bread or whole wheat zwieback has the further advantage that not much can be eaten of it. It cannot be devoured as wild beasts do, and the necessary chewing will fatigue even the most greedy gums. Whoever cannot bite the toasted bread on account of bad teeth may suck on it until it dissolves, a splendid way to restore declined strength. Whoever cannot miss potatoes should eat them only baked, and be sure and eat the jackets. What then remains for nutritious food after I am to give up all albuminous food like dried peas, lentils, beans, as much as possible? Thus many a reader will ask with a sigh. As to the value of meat, I have set forth my views elsewhere. The slight requirements in albumen are fully covered by sugary fruits. The banana, the nuts, combined with a few figs or dates, are first-class muscle formers and strength givers. The vegetable, cut small and made into salad, the salads themselves prepared with oil and plenty of fresh lemon juice, and all the splendid fruits and berries, including those of the South, are worthy of being served on the tables of gods. And when springtime comes and the last season's fruits, especially apples, are on the decline, and the new vegetables are not yet ready, does not Mother Nature help us out abundantly with oranges from the South? Will the aroma and wealth of these splendid products of nature not induce man to eventually become a fruit eater entirely? It is not possible for me to go into the question of food and its effects exhaustively in this book. For healthy people, these statements may suffice. To sick people, I recommend special prescriptions according to their state of health. If you are not already an owner of my Mucusless Diet Healing System lesson course, may I suggest that you secure a copy of this book. It may be mentioned that non-fasters and people easily succumbing to illness may at least follow the morning's fastings or non-breakfast plan. It would be better for all concerned not to eat anything before 10 o'clock a.m. and then nothing but fruits. The award for this little self-chastising will certainly show itself shortly, especially if the latter be kept up unfailingly. 3. Now just one more word to those who think it impossible to give up the accustomed mucus food, milk, bread, etc. To those unfortunate ones, I give this advice. Chew each bite of your food thoroughly, as recommended by the American Fletcher. In one word, Fletcherize. Not that the fruit eater should overlook this, but certainly the poison-laden mucus eaters must do so, especially if they do not wish to sink into their graves all too soon. The strong secretion of saliva in slow chewing decreases the formation of mucus and helps to prevent overeating. Of course, this group of individuals cannot expect to achieve in health and strength, retain youth and perseverance, physical and mental efficiency, as achieved by the faster and fruit eater. Once man is healthy, in my sense of the word, through fasting and fruit diet, that is, free from mucus, slime, and germs, and if he continues on the fruit diet, he, of course, need not fast any longer, for only then will he find pleasure in eating which he never dreamt of before. Only in this way will man find the way to happiness, harmony, and the solution of all health problems. Only through following this diet can man become want-free and get nearest to divinity. Chapter 3. The Fundamental Cause of Growing Old and Ugly. The Means Founded in Nature for Maintenance of Youth and Beauty. If according to protozoic primary laws, the lungs and skin would be given nothing but pure air and sun electricity, and the stomach and bowels nothing but sun food, i.e. fruits, which are being digested almost without rest, secreting only mucusless, pasteless, and germless cellulose, there seems to be no reason why the tube system of the human body should become defective, weaken, age, and finally break down entirely. Instead of the living energy cells of the fruit, one eats killed food, which biologically is meant for beast of prey, i.e. food chemically changed by air oxidation, decay, dead boiled, and robbed of its energy. Mucus accumulates, especially in the heating channel, stomach and bowels, of the tube machine, and slowly clogs up the channel and filters glands. The sum total of this defilement causes chronic defects, makes one old, and is the main factor in the nature of all disease. Growing old, therefore, is actually a latent disease, that is, a slow but constantly increasing disturbance in the operation of the motor of life. The chemistry of victuals gives the most reliable proof that deformity and decomposition have their source mainly in the lack of minerals in boiled culture food. If human ugliness as such, lost beauty, and symptoms of growing old can be made accountable for by wrong nourishment, then the theory of beauty and rejuvenation leads to a dietetic cure and a respective improvement of nourishment. But inasmuch as beauty, especially human beauty, cannot be absolutely defined, because everybody has a different taste, I can limit myself only to the main standards of aesthetic demands. The white corpse color of the light and sunless man of culture cannot be considered beautiful, since it emanates mainly from the white corpse color of the dead-boiled wrong food. What wonderful color a man can get who feeds on bleeding grapes, cherries, and oranges, and who systematically takes air and sunbathes, cannot be imagined by the modern artist of plein air painting. Mucus and at the same time lack of mineral matter means as much as lack of color. Just compare the food tables of Dr. Koenig, and you will find that the mucusless food, the fruits and starchless green leaf vegetables, occupy the first place as regards their contents of necessary mineral matter, especially lime. The size of a person, i.e. the circumference of the skeleton, depends, for instance, mainly on the amount of lime contained in the food. The Japanese want to increase the size of their race by meat, thereby going from bad to worse. All the pining away of size, deformities of the bones and faulty vision, and decay of the teeth is due to lack of lime. Through the boiling of milk and vegetables in modern cooking, the lime content is being eliminated. The enormous poorness in minerals of cultured food, especially of the meat as compared with fruit, is responsible for the coming of a toothless human race, as predicted even by physicians, and which is not merely a phantom of imagination. And instead of by fruit, these stuffs are being substituted by an organic preparation. The human organism does not assimilate one single atom of mineral substance which has not transmigrated into a plant of fruit, i.e. which has not become organic. The most modern disfigurement, the obesity, has clouded up our aesthetic feeling in this regard so much that we even do not know any longer the limit of the normal. I personally do not even consider the physical culturist, man of muscles of classic type, beautiful and as a standard for the ideal type of Germanic and Aryan races. Weight, shape, and especially circumference of body are too great. Every accumulation of fat is pathologic, and in this measure, unesthetic. No animal living in freedom is upholstered with fat like our modern weightlifters and strongmen. The reason is simply too much food and too much fluid. Relaxation and clogging of the entire system of vessels are the natural consequences. Grape sugar of the fruits and their nutritive salts are the right sources for a firm muscle substance by which a body disfattened and dismucused by fasting can be quickly rebuilt. The stoutness of face and body are dangerously on the increase. It is ugly and certainly pathologic. It is a curious fact that in our supposedly enlightened age, this accumulation of fat is considered not only beautiful, but even a sign of overabundant health, while the daily experience teaches that the slim, permanently youthful type possesses in every respect a greater force of resistance and generally reaches greater longevity. I should like to be shown just one person of 90 or 100 years with such obesity, which today is pronounced as beautiful and healthy, and which it is believed to fatten away tuberculosis. If fat people do not die in their best years through palpitation of the heart, apoplexy, or dropsy, they succumb to a slow emaciating, and the desire for food decreases in spite of all artificial stimulations of the appetite. The skin, especially of the face, having been subjected to extreme tension, becomes foldy and wrinkly. It has lost its youthful elasticity on account of insufficient and unhealthy blood circulation, as well as lack of light and sun. And now this relaxation of the skin is being tried to be prevented by salves and powders applied externally. The distinction and beauty of the features, the pureness and healthy color of the complexion, the clearness and natural size of the eyes, the charm of the expression and the color of the lips, age and become ugly to the extent of the expression and color of the mucus in the bowels, which we have recognized above as the central depot from which all the symptoms of diseases, and therefore those of age, are being fed. The beautiful roundness of cheeks, which at the same time increases the size of the nose, is nothing but a clogging up by mucus, which, as is well known, breaks out in case of a cold in the nose. Chapter 4. The Preservation of the Hair. Reasons for Becoming Bald and Gray. I come now to the most important and most striking system of the growing old, the falling out and getting gray of the hair, to which I must devote an entire section, because its appearance generally causes the first and greatest worry and pain over the coming of age, and because hitherto science has stood baffled in the face of this problem. The modern cutting short of the feminine, as well as the masculine hair on the head, and the alarming expansion and earliness of baldness have accustomed even an artistical eye so much to this appearance that we no longer become conscious of the fact of how seriously the aesthetic and harmonic figure of man is disturbed by the voluntary and involuntary hair decapitation. Man, who is not only intellectual, but also is an aesthetic product of nature, the crown of creation, is being robbed of the splendid crown of his head, the hair. They could be called living skulls, these beardless, colorless, and expressionless heads of today. Just imagine the most beautiful woman with a pate. Where is the man that would not turn away with horror, or a fashion sport of today, hewn in marble? In addition to that, the mustache shaped geometrically and angular or trimmed off entirely, then the modern clothing, which distinguishes itself from that of all the centuries by the greatest insipidity, and, this we find, beautiful reasons, for which the present-day man gets his beard removed and his hair cut down to a minimum length. The lack of beauty and therewith the unaesthetic appearance of hair and beard has become so general that in course of time the need of shaving and use of the clipper have come as a matter of course. In our time of equalization and all leveling, it is preferred, and rightfully so, to cut off these odor and, so to speak, revelation organs of inner man, instead of furnishing by ugly, disheveled, uneven, and hereditary morbid hair a living proof of the descendant's theory. Therewith we can understand the maltreatment of the hair. The thought has practically given rise that the getting ugly of one organ or of the entire organism means its inner morbidness, i.e., nature reveals internal physiological disturbances of an organism through disharmony of shape and color. The seriously ill